Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. My guest today is The New Yorker's Nick Romeo. He has a new book out. It's called The Alternative. The central idea behind the book is that despite all of the deep dissatisfaction, almost everyone feels the political status quo in the United States around the world. There are few examples in our public discourse of folks actually providing a clear articulation of what the alternatives to that status quo actually are. So in his book and in this conversation, Nick focuses on actual on-the-ground examples of how across the globe we are seeing alternate social structures and arrangements that can get at how people feel the economy is so unjust. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. I think it's a great starting point on a bunch of different places folks can go. And of course, a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation. Nick Romeo, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to be here.
So I want to start here because you just have a great title for the book that gets at a deeper idea that folks, especially those in the Gen Z audience, are going to kind of not really get the reference. Like, what is the reference to "there is no alternative," this alternative Margaret Thatcher phrase referring to?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I agree, it may be a bit of a deep cut. I think it kind of depends on your context. So Margaret Thatcher in 1980, you know, she made a speech in which she used the phrase. It was almost verbatim. What she actually said in this 1980 speech is, "There's no real alternative." And she was referring to a kind of suite of economic policies that came to be known as neoliberalism, and which tended to involve deregulation, the increase of free market thinking into as many domains of life as possible. So, you know, labor markets, healthcare, schools, trade, et cetera, all of this kind of got swept up in the phrase, "there's no alternative." And, you know, it's 1980, so memes were not as viral or as rapid, but it became a meme. The phrase, "there is no alternative," came to stand for a certain worldview in which economic status quo was presented as inevitable. Anyone who thinks we could have a different, better world is sort of implicitly dismissed as utopian. So that's the Margaret Thatcher quote that the title of the book alludes to. It actually, though, it really draws on a much older tradition of evoking physical laws, really quite akin to laws of physics, to kind of justify the status quo in the economic sphere. And I can give you some examples of that if that's interesting.
Yeah, and we'll pause because I kind of want to get into this because I'm coming at more of this issue from a political economy perspective than just straight up like economics. So what's interesting to me is that on the one hand, you could say that neoliberalism, especially in the 2020s, is the status quo. But what's interesting is in 1980, late 1970s, when the politicians like Reagan in the United States obviously are coming into power, neoliberalism wasn't really the status quo. The status quo is late stage New Deal America, New Deal consensus kind of coming apart in late 1970s. And then in Great Britain, it's the kind of come down from having to come to accord with the fact that World War II and World War I meant the empire, just by my definition, was like in decline. So I think at its best, like "there is no alternative" thinking was able to serve at a political level as a like anti-declinist kind of message. I'm kind of curious how you would think about how you hear that term, especially in the context of the 1980s.
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating point. I think you do sort of need political economy rather than just economics to really answer that question. One thing I talk about in the first chapter of the book, which is all about the battle within academia to control how economics gets taught, one thing I talk about is the Cold War. And, you know, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, one of the best-selling economics textbooks was by a guy named Paul Samuelson. And there was a little controversy at MIT over whether Samuelson's book should be taught. So today, Samuelson reads fairly conservative. I think a lot of people would not think of it as a radical text at all. At the time, though, in the 1950s, the president of MIT was receiving letters sort of accusing Samuelson, or at least insinuating that he was a communist, that the book was way too radical, and that it should not be taught. Now, Samuelson's interesting because he sort of famously says later in his career, something to the effect, you know, I'm not going to get it perfectly, but he says, I don't really care who writes a nation's laws if I get to write its economics textbooks. So, in fact, he did get to do that. And he, I think, was absolutely correct that there's enormous influence within the field of economics. So, in part because of its place in the imagination as a sort of quasi-natural science, people take things in economics books very seriously. So if you're told businesses cannot wage raises, that'll just cripple the economy, we'll have widespread unemployment. Or if you're told free trade is the best economic policy, there's a tendency to think that somehow science has shown this is true. And especially as mathematics became more and more integral to economics, you know, people were sort of understandably impressed. They would think, oh my God, look at all this modeling, look at all these numbers. These really, really brilliant people have just sort of told me how the world must be. And so I think the deeper sort of level to the Margaret Thatcher quote is once again the sense that what's inevitable and what's perceived as inevitable has enormous political stakes. So Samuelson realizes that. So do the businessmen in America who are writing to the administration at MIT saying, don't let Samuelson's book into this country. You know, he was basically introducing Keynesian economics to America, and they were terrified of that. They wanted a much more free market, a much more kind of Margaret Thatcher-esque vision of the economy. So I don't think I gave you a great answer, but what I'm trying to get at is just that, you know, the sort of the political atmosphere is crucial to shaping what gets perceived as possible versus what's just an inevitable, unchangeable part of the status quo.
And that's what the reason why I was bringing this up, because I just hear the framing you're giving of like the intersection of economics and politics, and then obviously how that relates to the broader like society as a whole. And I kind of hear, because I do a lot of interviews in this like post-neoliberalism space, and I'm basically looking to hear a politician or an actor or an intellectual kind of give their own version of there is no alternative. Because what you could basically say to yourself is like, what are Reagan and what are Thatcher doing? They're looking at the 1970s, the malaise, the shifting economic picture, the Cold War is going into a different transition state. And they're saying, look, the body politic in the West broadly doesn't feel satisfied with that. So our set of policies are the thing that have to be done to address those feelings that you basically have right now. I think that's separate from the economic case. So you could debate whether or not those were the right economic policies, but as a political program, they were quite successful. So I just am always just struck by kind of thinking like, what would the like post-neoliberalism, late stage, it's been 30, 40 years since the 1980s, like what would that version look like if you're giving a modern speech today? So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Like, what would you really say is just not working in these economic categories right now?
Well, I think I lost the thread a little. So are you asking if I were...
Basically, let me put it this way. So if you look at the there is no alternative speech, you would say, okay, mass unionization, big government, quote unquote, all these policies are not working and they are leading to the broader climate of decline that you as a voter are experiencing in the 1980s or early or late 1970s. I'm curious today, like the work that you're doing in the alternative, the work that a lot of folks in the post-neoliberalism space are doing is basically focused on saying there are all these things in the status quo right now that are just not working. And then those critiques of the status quo have to be transitioned to a broader, from just like a critique of the economy into an actual political program. What issues and areas that you catalog in the book would you identify as being the not working categories?
Got you. Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And, you know, I'm not sure that my answer to what's not working is particularly unique. The big things that come right to mind, and that in a way, almost every chapter of the book is dealing with environmental crisis or wealth inequality and some of the sociological and political implications of wealth inequality. Where I hope there is a little bit more of a unique intervention is the curation of potential solutions to these problems. So the problems, I think, are pretty widely agreed upon. And, you know, you have people, even on the conservative side, who are very concerned about environmental collapse and maybe to a lesser extent, extreme wealth inequality. In order to really sort of leverage enthusiasm and expand imaginative possibilities, you know, it's just a precondition that there has to be an alternative, right? So if I were sort of saying these are the things that must change, you know, that's, let me take that again. If I were saying these are the things that must change, that presupposes that, you know, we're not in a world in which, to sort of paraphrase Milton Friedman, economics is akin to one of the natural sciences. And in principle, it can be just as objective as physics or chemistry. You know, I'm a little skeptical of people who want to sort of remain closely wedded to that same model of economics and just replace all of their own goals with the neoliberal goals. So I think even if I might share your politics and say, yes, you know, living wages, job guarantees, worker ownership, participatory democracy, and economic democracy, even if I agree with all of those things, and I do, I write about those things in the book, if the way you're justifying those is just saying, it's inevitable, we must have these things because science has shown it, I think that's kind of falling under the same fallacy that Thatcher and Friedman and the entire tradition of economics as a natural science is committing. So this is maybe I'm getting a little bit too academic or subtle in this point, but
well, no, because my next question is about the academic part. So please keep going on it. I think this actually, I recently did an interview with Jennifer Burns, who just did her big Milton Friedman bio. The first part of the book is illustrating all of the debates and the dynamics that you're describing. So yeah, but please keep going, because I think this actually really matters.
Well, so, you know, to bring it back to Samuelson again, the American economist and textbook author, you know, I think his point about not caring about legislation as long as he can control the textbooks, right? If you took that seriously and you were a sort of Machiavellian political actor on the progressive side or on the left, you would say, well, look, let's just dress up all of our goals as natural science and try to push them through and hope for the best. And, you know, that might work, but you might also end up just sort of locked in endless ideological warfare and further eroding public trust in expertise. I think a more kind of reasonable and honestly a more democratic approach is just to be very transparent and explicit about what things are normative and philosophical, where do we have to have a debate about morals and values, and where can we just look at numbers? I'll give you a quick example. You know, in the book, I tell a little anecdote about an undergraduate in London who's studying economics, and they say to their teaching assistant, right, in class, they say, well, what are the data telling us about the ideal Gini coefficients? Gini is just a measure of inequality in a society, right? And so they say, what are the data showing us about like the optimal Gini? And it's a category error, right? The data cannot give you an answer and say, this is the best level of wealth inequality. Essentially, that's a philosophical, political question. You have to discuss values. You know, so.
Well, let's pause there, because I want to make this very clear, because this is what's interesting. Because, for example, the question, like, what is like the optimal like Gini coefficient? It's like, well, does optimal mean you don't have a civil war? Does it mean you don't have like favelas where like all the rich people like live in like a nice gated community, and all the people are like are poor? Does it mean that you've optimized, we're hitting 4% economic growth over all other costs, even if it pollutes the environment? I think that's such a good example, because I just came up with five different things that we could have 10 podcast episodes about, like just on their own one as an individual metric.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're going to end up teaching economics in a way that frankly leads to more complacency, more of the status quo, more financial crises, and more of this kind of constricted imagination, which is precisely what Margaret Thatcher was counting on and also really sort of perpetuating with her speech.
I think what's interesting here is I took AP micro or macro back in high school, and I just remember like the section on free trade, which kind of gives the, like, you know, you could make oranges and you could or you could grow oranges, or you could grow this other widget, and then you could trade these things. And that's basically the way that free trade works. And I think if there's an interesting area of bipartisan consensus post 1990s, is just that, like, okay, hey, when we looked at trade policy debates, everything from should we admit China to the WTO to, okay, like, is it possible to, like, retrain workers if we're going to do trade adjustment assistance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We kind of, like, stuck too literally to the idea of, like, economics as being that, like, once again, to your point, like, empirically driven, we could identify, like, the optimal number of oranges that were growing relative to what China could be growing. And I think that's just, like, a good example of how, at its best, like, economics could serve as a means of, like, thinking through societal debates and problem sets. But if we, like, kind of stick too rigidly to an 80s, 90s style economics, it actually doesn't reveal, it actually kind of confuses and causes more trouble down the line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a pretty famous quote from John Maynard Keynes where he says that if economists could manage to get themselves thought of like dentists, this would be a splendid thing. I think what he's getting at is just what you're saying, really, that, you know, there is a contribution for economics. It can clarify debates. It gives you relevant empirical understanding of a huge range of issues. That being said, there is a difference between, like, dentistry and heart surgery. And there's a difference between sort of these narrowly economic questions and these much broader political and philosophical questions about what's the value of an ecosystem? What's an ideal level of wealth inequality or equality? What do we owe to working class people in our country, but also around the world, who make a lot of the stuff that we consume? These are not just questions for economists. And so I think that's what Keynes had in mind. And I think that's still something that's worth taking seriously today.
I think something interesting that also comes from Jennifer Burns's Milton Friedman bio is she's really making clear that Milton Friedman as an economist is profoundly shaped by him rising in the economics field during the Great Depression. And so much of what late mid 20th century economics becomes about is, like, thinking through why did the Great Depression happen? What was the proper response? What mistakes were made, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'd be kind of curious, because you're writing about ways that, like, the academic space is shifting through these debates and these concepts, what are ways that this, like, post 2008 financial crisis world has raised new problems and questions that any, like, rising economist is going to be thinking about as they're defining their careers and interest sets?
You know, I think that's a really subtle, interesting question. And based on my reporting and research, you know, I talked with a lot of economics professors around the world. It's sort of a fascinating sociological experience, you know, just to talk to a bunch of experts in a field, to hear them complain, to hear them sort of think about their own motives, their own aspirations. You know, I mean, one thing that a lot of people do seem aware of is that if economists want to sort of remain relevant, they have to take seriously things that a lot of their students care about, right? Like in the first chapter of the book, I write about this new textbook for Econ 101 that's called CORE. And CORE's ambition is really to bring more of an empirical, but also a political lens into economics education. So it's not just the kind of idealized abstractions of supply and demand and efficient markets. It's much more engaged with game theory, with behavioral economics, but also with questions like that involve climate change, democracy, and inequality. One thing the researchers at CORE did was they actually kind of created word frequency analyses of their book versus other leading textbooks like, you know, Greg Mankiw's book. He's an economics professor at Harvard, best-selling book in the world, but other textbooks as well that are much more conventional. And, you know, it was interesting just to look at these word clouds where you could actually see a kind of visual representation of the density of attention paid to certain topics. Again, things like climate change, democratic collapse, wealth inequality. These are things that economics can illuminate, but they're also things that students, especially post 2008, if you're not talking about this in an economics class, students are kind of confused. And yet, in order to talk about those things, you have to assume this more political and philosophical lens for all the reasons we've been discussing, right? That there's not some data set that's ever going to give you the optimal Gini coefficient.
Something I'm curious about, why are questions okay? So I'd love to hear an example then, because if you're discussing climate change and democracy, like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, why does that belong in an econ textbook and not in a political science class or a engineering class or a climate science class? Like what is the specific lens through which we could consider those questions in the textbook context?
You know, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure that it does belong exclusively to economics. I mean, my view, I guess, would be that, again, you know, to quote Keynes, he thought that economists were really political philosophers. He has this wonderful line where he says the good economist must be mathematician, historian, statesman, and philosopher. So that's a tall order, right? That's hard to get through in 15 weeks of an undergrad class. But I think what he's speaking to is that there's a necessary breadth of training that is requisite to really doing serious work as an economist. And you know, I like that you mentioned earlier the phrase political economy, because that for a lot of the history of the field of economics, political economy really was the way that people referred to the subject that became economics. So this narrowing down to just mathematics, when, as Keynes and many other thinkers realized, there are these historical, diplomatic, philosophical dimensions. I guess I think that's unfortunate. I maybe I'll pause there. I have a few other
Well,
thoughts,
because
but
what's interesting
yeah.
is what you're basically just saying is, because I was asking you about like the more politically tinged topics, but like, kind of your point is, if you just by definition exclude the policy topics you mentioned, it does kind of reduce econ to math, and you have some interesting like stats in the book, like towards the beginning where you're talking about how like if you're surveying like econ serious econ students, like they're obviously intensely math focused, but they're skeptical of adjacent categories. And not just like in terms of like climate change, but sort of like other baselines of knowledge and information that they actually need to do their job well. So here's why I'll kind of ask you the question. It seems the way we can determine what should be the way to determine the scope of econ from my perspective would be, what does our society expect from economists? Do you know what I mean? Like, what jobs are we actually expecting an economist to provide in the 21st century?
I'm tempted to say that we treat them like priests. You know, we expect almost divine truth, oracular pronouncement, but we also, in some sense, we treat them like priests in that we tend not to question too closely some of the ex cathedra utterances from the high oracles. That's a little glib. I'm not sure how seriously I would defend that if
Well,
pushed.
one thing on this. Maybe it's not that they're treated as well. I think in some, actually, especially in ideological context, I think when people are weaponizing the economics profession and economists, they are treated kind of like priests. But I think like the better, not that you're being bad faith, but I think a way to articulate it is we kind of treat the work of an economist as being akin to the work of Albert Einstein. And this is the point you're making about science, which is like, look, this is just math. You could not like free trade policy, but that's how the math comes out. Like that's the way the world has to kind of go. So I think that's why I think the debate around inevitabilism and whether or not there's an alternative is like that's where it really matters, because you're treating something that's actually driven by values as something that can just be determined by putting some numbers in, like not just a fancy calculator, but kind of in that context. But go on.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, one thing that might sort of focus this point a little bit would be to talk about externalities and true pricing. So, you know, in the second chapter of the book, I get into some level of depth on this family of accounting methods that's sometimes called true cost accounting. I kind of like the phrase true price, which is this idea, and it's also the name of an organization in Amsterdam, but true price is the idea that, you know, for any given good or service, the whole set of externalities that the production of that and the transportation. Actually, let me back up. I think that was a little windy. I'll take this again. Okay. One thing that I think could focus this topic a little bit is the idea of true pricing. In the second chapter of the book, I profile an organization out of the Netherlands that is developing a whole set of accounting methods. And their basic goal is to try to include more of the externalities of goods back into the price signal itself. So, for example, let's say you buy organic tomatoes. Organic means it has a legal definition. It means that certain pesticides were not used. But it doesn't actually say anything about the conditions for the workers. So true price is kind of paying attention to the fact that currently we have a patchwork of terms and labels, but they're not totally illuminating. Like if you just want to do the right thing as a consumer, or if as a policymaker, you want to know the actual total cost of something like the US food system or one supply chain, let's say for microprocessors. Right now, you know, you can pay attention to environmental things, you can pay attention to human rights things, you can pay attention to transportation, like is this good getting delivered with a fleet of electronic vehicles, electric vehicles. But if you wanted just a single metric that said, here is what all of that adds up to, you know, there's nothing that can tell you that. True price is trying to solve this problem. I think if you think about economics as a field that is becoming increasingly empirical, true price is a really interesting example, because what they're doing is basically saying, look, we're going to look at all sorts of studies for all sorts of products, and we're going to come up with the best possible data that we have on the currently unpriced costs of production and consumption. Why are we doing that? It's not just an academic exercise. They're doing that in order to actually give a very important signal to consumers, to companies, to governments that can change behavior. So to me, it's a very compelling marriage of the sort of mathematics and morality components that are both arguably central to economics.
I think I'm glad you gave that example of what they're doing in the Netherlands, because a key, you said this earlier in the podcast, but I want to emphasize this for listeners. The key point here is this isn't a book. I mean, obviously the book has an ideological bent, but this isn't just like the next manifesto about like why neoliberalism is bad. Like you're giving these specific examples of alternate models that can take in some of these premises we're discussing. So I'd love to hear some other examples, like maybe the jobs guarantee. That'd be an interesting one to kind of go through here for listeners.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, one chapter in the book does a deep dive on a job guarantee that is currently being piloted in a town outside of Vienna, Austria. It's a really interesting town for a few reasons, one of which is that it was the location of a study on unemployment in the 1930s that became an early classic of sociology. And what those earlier researchers found in the 1930s was just how psychologically devastating lack of employment can be. Even people who did have enough to eat, when they were surveyed and interviewed, they basically described what today we would describe in mental health terms as a kind of total collapse, anxiety, depression, purposelessness, lack of motivation. You know, they had more free time. They were, after all, they were unemployed, but they did less. They stayed in bed all day. They didn't go out to see their friends. So fast forward 90 years, this same town gets chosen as the site of a job guarantee. So earlier they're studying unemployment. Now they're studying guaranteed employment. A few interesting features of how that study is set up.
One and quick is thing, could you define just the jobs guarantee? Like, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but like, what does it mean specifically?
Yeah, so anyone who has been unemployed beyond a certain number of weeks and would like to participate is guaranteed a job that they help to design. That's how it works in Vienna, or outside of Vienna. It's a small town outside Vienna. So what it means is if you're unemployed and you want to join, you can. It's important that it's voluntary, right? So this distinguishes it from a kind of workfare where you're compelled to take any job, whether or not you're interested or even able to do it, really. This is something that as a participant in the program, you get to say, I have these interests, I have these skills. And, you know, you work collaboratively with a social worker who then says, okay, here are some of the local needs in the community. So there's an effort to sort of make it useful in some broader social sense, but also psychologically kind of compelling to the individual. Both of those elements are important. So one thing that's quite compelling about this is that they actually pay attention to psychology as an economic factor. So, you know, if you were thinking about some of the themes we discussed earlier and you had a very narrow lens, kind of econometric focus on this kind of pilot, you might say, all I care about are, you know, any effects on the broader labor market, right? Do other employers have trouble filling jobs if we have a job guarantee? Do people save their money? You might only look at those numbers. The economists who are studying this out of Oxford, they're not doing that. They're doing very detailed psychological surveys. They're collaborating with sociologists, and they're sort of giving importance and weight to this subjective dimension of, like, do I have more motivation? Is my well-being as I experience it higher? And they're saying these are legitimate reasons, right? I mean, it's almost like, it seems, maybe depending on your point of view, it seems so obvious that, like, of course it matters whether people are not miserable and depressed. I mean, I quote in this chapter a meta-analysis of suicide around the world, and unemployment is implicated in a huge number of early deaths, right? This is not really a controversial finding. But once again, it's like the expansion of economics to pay attention to things that might previously have been classified as epidemiological or psychological. It's like, no, this is important for economists to think about. And if you're designing a program that gives people a sort of guaranteed thing to do, so there's community, there's purpose, there's time structure, all those elements that the researchers in the 1930s found missing from the lives of the people in this town, those are vital to well-being and mental health. And of course, these have political and sociological ripple effects. So it's a fascinating example of a kind of expanded vision of economics that's actually being operationalized in a pilot program, helping people. You know, so I spent some time in the town, and talking with folks in this job guarantee is fascinating because they come from a huge range of backgrounds. I mean, some of them have advanced degrees. Some of them have not finished high school. Some of them are immigrants. Some of them are from Austria. Everyone who was given the offer to participate chose to. So whatever their background, people preferred this to just remaining on unemployment benefits, which are quite generous in Austria. So if your view is like, look, humans are just lazy, if they can sort of get a free lunch, get money for doing nothing, they'll just stay at home and watch, binge watch TV and do nothing. Like, this is such a dramatic refutation of that idea. Like, people wanted to work. They wanted to do something interesting with their days.
I think the question, though, is I'd love to hear more about your point around how they kind of like work with the relevant body to like kind of find or construct a job or work that's interesting, because I think, I don't know, like there's the skeptical side of me is like, look, like if I could create like a job where I like record podcasts, so I guess I kind of did do this, but if I could create a job where I'm on unemployment and I like interview smart people like you all day, obviously I would do that. But it's a question whether that or not that's like economically efficient or like a valid like trade-off from a societal perspective. So like, how does the actual construction of work come about?
Two points are important here. One is that it costs less to run this job guarantee than it does to pay for unemployment benefits. This was strategically important in the design of the study because it preempts the argument that, you know, we can't afford this. On the contrary, this money is getting spent on unemployment benefits anyway. So if we're going to be spending the money and people are happier and would prefer to be doing something, then the question is, can we find activities and jobs that are both satisfying to people and fulfilling some social need? And, you know, the answer seems to be yes so far. So people in the job guarantee, some of the people I met did sort of greening work, you know, in the town. They would do planting, renovation of landscape, you know, depending on their health conditions. Again, right? Mm-hmm. It's a sort of tailored program. So you'll work with a social worker. If you can only do 20 hours a week before your back starts hurting, okay, you do 20 hours and then we'll do something else for the other hours, right? Other people were working with kids. Others were working with animals. One idea that they had, which I'm not sure if they have actually been able to launch it, but one idea was like taking walks with older people who are lonely and shut into their apartments, basically, who don't have young people. So you can imagine, like, with a little creativity, care work, the green economy, there are lots of things that private markets are actually not particularly good at satisfying the scale of need for, you know, for a society. And yet a job guarantee, because it has a little bit more freedom, they can try to address some of those urgent issues. You know, if you had a national one, it's sort of fun to brainstorm a little about how a green transition, infrastructure work. I think there'd be no shortage of sort of socially important, but also psychologically fulfilling jobs for folks to do.
I think what's fascinating here is that as I was thinking about this idea and the way you're framing it, I caught myself kind of framing it in economics terms in a way that kind of gets to the point we're making at the start of the conversation, where I'm like, okay, well, look, if I'm debating this policy, like how like economically productive is it to pay someone to like walk grandma, not their grandma, like you should always walk your own grandmother if she's lonely, but like, you know, to have someone walk another elderly person around, like, is that like the best use of money? But I was just framing the entirety of that policy debate in this purely like GDP growth maximizing like economics trade-off, rather than a question of like alternate metrics, which is like, hey, like, what's the mental health of your village going to look like? Hey, like, to what level does that like feed broader community engagement in the society in the first place? Hey, to what degree does that like encourage someone to like maybe get into multifamily housing or like a multi-generational housing unit? It's just kind of interesting how like there are all these like different rubrics by which we can assess policy. And it's not to say that the economic one isn't important. It's not to say that GDP growth isn't important. It's just to say that like we shouldn't, I think the point you're making in the book is that we shouldn't be too constrained by a specific one that limits the specific problem sets we have.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. You know, one other sort of point that people make when they're discussing job guarantees is just about the importance of an outside option. So, you know, if I'm a worker and I don't have a lot of training, I'm sort of looking basically for work, and my options without a job guarantee, let's say they're only kind of gig work or a service job that's low paying, kind of low quality work. As soon as a job guarantee offers me another option, I have some bargaining power. So the upward pressure on wages and pressure on private sector folks to actually improve conditions, to make work more meaningful, maybe to give me more advance notice before my schedule changes. I mean, whatever the sort of issues people have with low wage, low quality work, another potential value of a job guarantee is that it would provide people with bargaining power. This can actually have very high stakes, right? So there was a study in America on tipped subminimum wage where, you know, in some states, basically, restaurant workers have to rely on tips to make up a lot of their wage. Now, if you have a state that does that and another state that doesn't, so a state that just guarantees a wage and you don't have to kind of play nice with customers to get tips, to get to your basic wage, this is a sort of interesting natural experiment. You look at two states that have different policies. As soon as people are not depending on tips as heavily, rates of reported sexual harassment of waitresses go way down. They cut almost in half. So if you think about a job guarantee as an expansion of that same idea, suddenly people might have more options. Whereas before it was like, my only job is at a place where my boss sucks and customers treat me badly. As soon as I have a guaranteed option somewhere else, either I take it, or if I don't take it, I can still sort of, the knowledge that I could take it could still motivate better behavior by my boss. You know, it can motivate, like, if you're not keeping anyone at your business, suddenly you have to sort of rethink let me take that again. I don't know where I flubbed that. Let's see. So if you think about a job guarantee as an expansion of the same concept, suddenly people who have an outside option don't have to remain in abusive environments at work. So that's another value that a lot of economists and policy folks talk about with a job guarantee.
I think the last big question, I'd be really curious. To your point, you're talking to people all around the world. These experiments are happening all around the world. To what degree has this writing you've been doing here and in the New Yorker, obviously, informed how you think about what makes America unique as a country versus other countries? So, for example, the way you would debate a jobs guarantee in an Austrian village, I'm sure it's quite different than the way you debate a job guarantee in America, like for good or for ill, right? So I'm just curious, like, what has this taught you about ways that, like, our national identity or even national story, like, more focus on individualism rather than communitarian ideals? How has that kind of, like, come through in your reporting?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. The role of culture is a little nebulous, but I think it's absolutely vital, right? I mean, in a way, it connects to just what we've been talking about in different forms, this whole conversation, right? You can't necessarily quantify all of these cultural forces, and yet they are absolutely decisive. Here's an example. I have a chapter in the book, and this was also a New Yorker story where I spent a lot of time in Mondragon. This is a town in northern Spain, home to an enormous network of worker-owned cooperatives. These cooperatives have what to an American sounds almost like a science fiction utopian pay ratio between the highest and the lowest paid workers. It's always capped at 6 to 1. And at many of the co-ops, it's much smaller, 3 to 1, 2 to 1. And yet they're enormously successful. They do industrial manufacturing, they make jet engines, elevators, trains. They have a consulting firm. They have grocery stores. So this cooperative model is kind of content neutral. You can pour lots of different specific industries and businesses into it. And yet, a lot of the folks in Mondragon, if you ask them, like, well, how does this work? Why does this work? How are you able to have such a low ratio of executive to worker pay? They love to talk about culture, right? They talk about the sort of the founder of the co-ops who was a priest. They talk about cooperative schools, building cooperative people. They talk about culinary clubs, which are places where people just kind of get together. These clubs are cooperatively run, so they basically sort of give you access to a restaurant quality kitchen with your friends, and people trade nights throughout the month. You go cook, you hang out, you drink, you talk with your friends. Everyone pays a little bit, and it's like cheaper than going out all the time, but kind of as much fun. So the idea that culture is at the root of it, that's how folks there tend to explain it. I don't think it's really controversial to say that it's more complex than that. Culture drives some of it, but then these structures themselves drive culture, right? So you have this kind of complicated feedback loop where, if you've worked in a co-op your whole life, and you're given voice at work, right? It's democratically run, so you're voting on important decisions. Like this is going to show up in how you raise your kids, how you go to a school board meeting, what you expect from local government, what you expect from national government. So I think it's a vitally important question. And if I were to sort of generalize about America versus Europe, those were the two areas of real focus in the book. It's not surprising to me that one of the more compelling things I found in America were models of addressing wealth inequality that are largely private sector and that largely depend on individuals. So you do have really interesting things with investment funds, private equity, using huge amounts of capital to acquire businesses and convert them into worker ownership models. I think it's a really compelling model, but it's also in some ways a very American model. Right? It's you're sort of bypassing government and you're using private capital to distribute capital more effectively. So that's certainly a kind of generalization that I think has some validity, is that the kind of individualistic American model of wealth acquisition that's relatively unfettered and then sort of relying on individual generosity to redistribute it, as opposed to these more institutional structures, whether it's participatory budgeting in Portugal, which I talk about, or worker ownership models like in Mondragon, or even the job guarantee in Austria. These are maybe a little bit more characteristically European interventions.
So here is the last big question here. The key thing, if we're thinking about Keynes and Friedman, they are coming to power and writing these very powerful econ textbooks at a period of high institutional trust in the United States. Higher ed is kind of at its peak from a trust perspective. Like Milton Friedman, part of his skill set as an economist is he's also able to write these textbooks, but also then go and host an incredibly popular PBS documentary that talks about his political vision within the economics profession. Now that we are in an era of lower trust, there's just a lot more noise out there. You could get the most prominent, like let's say you had Thomas, you probably wouldn't select Thomas Piketty, but let's say you had Thomas Piketty do a PBS 10 part PBS show, would be way less impactful from yeah. Friedman, whether or not you disagree or agree with either person. It's just a different dynamic. To what degree do you think in the 21st century, economics as a profession, the whole point about I'd much rather write the textbook than do the other point that you made at the start of the episode, to what degree is that still true? Or has the world just shifted too much?
I think it's less true. You know, I think that's a really astute point. And I guess I would say that the sort of the decline in influence is not really limited to economics authors. It's I think part of a broader decline in influence that, you know, like the New Yorker magazine is probably less influential than it was 50 years ago. Same with the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, same with the big TV networks. I think there's so much noise, there's so much competition for attention, and there's so much distrust. You know, whatever you think of the legitimacy of that distrust, there's so much distrust of institutions that you're absolutely right that there's a decline in influence. I mean, one thing that's a little bit hopeful about that is that it can be less easily abused, right? A lot of the folks I talked with when reporting on the battle to reform economics education, they were basically of the opinion that economics is increasingly, at least as an educational sort of field, it's increasingly falling behind the real world. That you have people, and these are a lot of the folks that the rest of the chapters of the book talk about, you have people who are sort of just doing things already, right? They're creating a new worker ownership model. They're creating a nonprofit to enable supply chain externality tracking, right? So I think some level of catch up is happening where econ is kind of looking out at the world and saying, okay, if we're going to remain relevant, like there are all of these initiatives, there are all of these kind of analytical and political frameworks that are, you know, sometimes being created by economists and sometimes not, sometimes being created by other academics, private sector folks, democratic movements, like participatory budgeting or workplace democracy, economic democracy. All of these movements, I think, like a hopeful way to look at the declining influence of elite institutions and education, a hopeful way is that there's more space for other folks. There's more breathing room. There's more opportunity to sort of create something interesting and prove that it works. And then maybe the journalists like me and the academics and the other folks come along and say, hey, this is cool. Like, people should pay attention to this. So it's a different model of almost idea innovation.
I think what we'll close with then is the really encouraging thing from what you just said then is if we acknowledge that there are unsolved problems and unanswered questions in the world, the degree to which institutions and individuals and experts, you can use these kind of interchangeably, the degree to which they can focus their attention on those questions and those issues will be how you retain your actual relevance. So you're not going to get, you can't just like, you know, it's like 50 years ago, like there's a world where you could just write the New Yorker article and it would be the definitive topic on the issue. All the right people would read it. Think back to the 1990s when people called the New Republic magazine like Air Force One's in-flight magazine. That was just the deal. That concept doesn't even make any sense today. But it does just mean that if you could say to yourself, okay, separate from US-China policy, everyone and their cousin is trying to figure out how you deal with a supply chain crunch if there's an invasion of Taiwan, or if there's a blockade, or if there are trade tensions. If we can be the institution that does that work, before that work is inherently on top of everyone's hands, that's how we're relevant. And that's a separate question than are, you know, 100 million people tuning in to watch you on PBS on Friday. So I think it's just like encouraging to have institutions and figures and professions say, hey, we need to be relevant. We have to stick with the time because that's how we're actually helpful, rather than kind of like rehashing yesterday's answers.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I share your views on that. I think that's a nice way to frame it. Yeah.
Point of agreement is a great way to end a conversation. Nick, thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment. The book is out now, and I hope everyone picks up a copy. It's available in our bookshop.
Thank you, Marshall. Really enjoyed it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.